Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Thursday, January 5th, 2006. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Coming up, a Portland policeman shot and killed a man sleeping in a stolen car yesterday. It's the first police shooting of 2006, and today is January 5th. The Supreme Court has ruled that Jose Padilla can be transferred to civilian authorities in Miami. And in Jerusalem, Ariel Sharon is in critical condition after doctors worked most of the night to control severe cerebral hemorrhaging. Portland area weather, mostly cloudy, rain along the coast, slight chance of rain inland this afternoon. Temperatures in the 50s tonight, rain spreading inland, temperatures in the high 40s to low 50s. Portland police shot and killed a motorist in northeast Portland early yesterday morning. The details remain vague. KBOO's Sheila Whiteside reports.
A Portland police lieutenant fatally shot a man in a stolen car early this morning in a mansion-lined street in northeast Portland. The man's identity has not been released. Neither police nor media reports have indicated whether the man was armed or dangerous. He was reportedly sleeping in a car with the engine running just before the shots were fired. At 2:15 this morning on Wednesday, January 4th, 2006, Southeast Precinct Lieutenant Jeffrey M. Kerr responded to the 6400 block of Northeast Alameda Street after receiving information that a suspicious car was parked in the area. The sequence of events are complicated. The first emergency call came from the lieutenant's sister, who saw the car stopped near her house and called her brother to ask advice, police said. Because Kerr was on duty and relatively close, he decided to drive by the location and determine if there was a police-related problem. Kerr arrived and parked behind the suspicious car, an Oldsmobile Cutlass reported stolen on December 30th, police said. It's not clear if the lieutenant knew the car was stolen, police said. The lieutenant walked up to the car, which was idling, and saw an unconscious man behind the wheel. Kerr called for a second police officer and attempted to make contact with the occupant. The lieutenant then opened the car door and attempted to wake up the driver. While Kerr was attempting to wake up the driver, another officer arrived at the scene. The driver then apparently woke up and sharply accelerated the car, driving over the curb and into a nearby tree, police said. As the officers attempted to remove the man from the car, the driver attempted to again sharply accelerate the car and free himself from the curb and tree, police said. As the car was apparently rocking back and forth, the officer discharged the taser and the lieutenant shot the man, police said. Immediately after the shooting, officers called for medical and attempted to revive the man. Homicide detectives and investigators from East County Major Crimes Team are conducting this investigation. This is KBOO News. I'm Sheila Whiteside.
The family of a man shot and killed by Portland police at a downtown bus terminal 2 years ago has filed a federal civil rights suit. Police shot Jose Angel Padilla, 22, of Yakima on January 3, 2004. They said he was holding a knife to a woman he knew. The suit, filed December 29th, claims that the Portland Police Bureau fosters a shoot-first culture that discouraged the officers from trying to avoid using deadly force. Police did not call for a negotiator or a specialty team. The suit claims officers also ignored the women's pleas not to shoot, according to the suit. The suit also challenges the constitutionality of the Police Bureau's deadly force policy. A federal judge in a different police shooting case is considering that question. A security guard at the Greyhound bus terminal called 911, saying a man with a knife was threatening his girlfriend inside the downtown bus terminal. Other people called and said the woman was on her knees and the man was holding her by the hair with a knife to her throat. The suit named Hubbard and fellow Portland police officers Michael K. Jones and Sarah L. Taylor, Sarah I. Taylor, Hubbard filed the fatal shot. Police Chief Derek Foxworth said shortly after the shooting that Hubbard acted to save the woman's life. A Multnomah County grand jury found no criminal wrongdoing. This from the Oregonian.
Portland police arrested an anti-military recruitment activist last night outside an Army recruiting center on Northeast Broadway Street. The activist, known only as Sprout, was charged with, quote, improper position on the highway, unquote, and obstructing the sidewalk, according to a spokesman for the Portland police. She was cited last night and released. According to the activist's account posted on Portland Indie Media, about a dozen anti-military recruiters were standing and holding no war signs on the sidewalk and in the parking lane. One of the vets for peace who was present was waving the group's flag. Two Portland police cruisers arrived on the scene. According to the activists, officers threatened to cite everyone standing in the parking lane, as well as anyone who had left lit candles on the sidewalk. According to the Portland police spokesman, only Sprout was cited. Members of the Portland Anti-Military Recruitment Coalition were unavailable at press time.
Synthetic gym floors in 20 elementary schools in the Salem-Keizer School District recently were tested for airborne mercury. Eight of these schools had detectable levels. This from the Salem Statesman Journal. At Cummings Elementary, the mercury levels are considered unsafe. The other seven schools had levels in the safe range based on federal health guidelines. However, Cummings was tested twice, once with high levels of mercury and once with no mercury in the air. A third test will be necessary to confirm which test was accurate. At the other seven schools, the gyms will continue to be used for PE classes. However, school officials will move before and after school programs to limit their gym time. They will continue testing to ensure that levels are acceptable for normal gym use. This fall, the Oregon Department of Education released information stating that certain synthetic gym floors that were installed in the 70s could be releasing airborne mercury. Overexposure to this substance has been reported to cause health issues.
Oregon schools are using groundwater for heating and cooling, employing skylights, clerestory windows, and lights and light shelves to reduce or eliminate the need for artificial lighting. They're using natural ventilation to lower heating and cooling bills. District building managers report energy savings of as much as 50% in the new buildings. Ross Kane, facilities manager for the Dalles School District, said the energy-efficient middle school built 2 years ago is saving the district about $50,000 a year in energy costs. Dave Church, physical plant director for the North Clackamas School District, said the energy bill for Clackamas High School is similar to those of smaller, older district schools that are used far less than the new high school. This from the Oregonian.
Portland City Council got off to a new start for 2006 yesterday. KB's Andy Seaton has a story.
The Portland City Council started the new year dealing with the past, present, and future. The council dealt with the past by dealing with Portland General Electric. They reauthorized the city attorney to investigate PGE on several fronts. Portland City Attorney Linda Ming lists them.
To investigate the activities upon which the calculation and collection of the Multnomah County income tax was based. This resolution asks that we investigate that as well. It also includes that we look at the basis as well as the amount for the taxes that were collected. And then the last change is in the last direction in item 5 that directs us to look for any additional information that would be of assistance in determining the reasonableness of PGE rates.
The ordinance passed unanimously. The council then took up an emergency request from Tryon Life Community Farm to assist with the purchase of its land. The project was almost derailed by Commissioner Eric Sten because of a recent right-wing support. Brenna Bell, president of the Tryon Farm Board, broke the sad news.
Today, the Oregonian editorial board came out in support of us. So you'll be in good company supporting TLC Farm. The Oregonian actually won't
awesome
get on your
editorial we've had.
You know, I have to note, we were also on the Lars Larson show yesterday, and even he said at the end that he thinks it might be a good idea for people to contribute. So.
Oh, you just lost me votes.
Sorry.
It was tough.
I never voted for anything that Lars and the editorial board.
Luckily.
However, these partisan differences were set aside and the item passed unanimously. Looking to the future, the council also took testimony on raising public art funding. They want to raise the current 1.33% to 1.2%. The proposal will also set aside 10% of the new funds for maintenance of existing art projects. The rules and procedures governing public art will also be clarified and strengthened. The final vote will be taken next week. I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
About 300 progressive activists, many in their 20s and early 30s, will converge on Mount Hood this weekend for a political conference aimed at mobilizing and inspiring a new generation to get involved. Called Rebooting Democracy, The conference is sponsored by the Bus Project. The Bus Project has recruited thousands of young activists for door-to-door canvassing, voter registration drives, and political pressure campaigns conducted via email. Organizers will encourage attendees to debate and rank 10 initiative measures, contending for Oregon's November ballot, and then commit money or volunteer labor to the campaigns. Many younger people have grown up in the Sizemore era of tax cutting, anti-union, and other conservative measures sponsored by Bill Sizemore and Oregon Taxpayers United. The goal of this conference is to restore grassroots energy and progressive values to Oregon initiative campaigns. Featured speakers include Jim Hightower, radio commentator and former Texas Agriculture Commissioner, and Andre Chaney, speechwriter for then-Vice President Al Gore and author of a new book called The Next Deal. Homegrown speakers include two potential 2006 candidates for governor, ex-governor John Kitzhaber, and Republican Senator Ben Westland, who's sowing the seeds for running as an independent.
Democratic Governor Ted Kulongoski's handling of a $170 million hole in the state Human Services Agency's budget is becoming an issue in the governor's race. A potential Democratic challenger, State Senator Vicky Walker, is demanding that Kulongoski convene a special session of the legislature to ensure that the agency remains able to provide health care and other services to low-income, elderly, and disabled Oregonians. A Republican contender, Portland lawyer Ron Saxton, said the budget gap is a startling example of Kulongoski's passive style of managing state agencies that now is putting state services at risk. The criticism by the challengers follows last week's announcement by the Human Services Agency that increasing Medicaid caseloads and decreasing federal matching dollars could leave the agency $172 million short of what it needs to maintain current services. Kulongoski's office has said that talk of a special session is premature, and that the government has ordered better forecasting procedures be put in place. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
The Bush administration won a temporary victory when the Supreme Court ruled that Jose Padilla can be transferred to civilian authorities in Miami. The justice's decision yesterday overruled a lower court which had attempted to block the transfer in a rebuke to the White House. The Supreme Court said it would decide later whether to consider a broader appeal by Padilla challenging President Bush's authority to order the indefinite detention of suspected terrorists. Padilla's detention as an enemy combatant has been the subject of multiple court rulings and criticism by civil liberties groups. He was arrested at Chicago's O'Hare Airport and put in military custody, where he was held without charges for several months and denied traditional legal rights such as access to an attorney. The Supreme Court had been asked to use Padilla's case to define the scope of a president's power over American citizens taken into custody on U.S. soil. The justices had been expected to agree to hear his appeal, but the government brought criminal charges against him in Florida and then argued that the appeal was moot.
In a possible message to would-be deserters in Iraq, the U.S. Marines have charged a pensioner for not going to war in Vietnam 40 years ago. Former Marine Private Jerry Texiero was found selling boats and classic cars in Florida under a false name. He was identified as a result of a fraud conviction in 1998, which he said was the result of wrongdoing by a former partner. 7 years later, Marine investigators from an AWOL apprehension unit compared his fingerprints with their records of deserters. He was first arrested by Florida police in August and handed over to the military on December 21st. Texiero, who is 65 years old, is being held in Camp Lejeune, a Marine base in North Carolina. No date has been set for preliminary hearings. If he's convicted of desertion in a court-martial, he could serve 3 years in a military jail. His lawyers were due to discuss the case with him yesterday. Todd Ensign, the legal director of Citizen Soldier, an advocacy group representing conscientious objectors, wrote to Camp Lejeune's commanding officer, Brigadier General Robert Dickerson, asking, "Why are scarce Marine resources being squandered on the persecution of prosecution of a senior citizen whose only crime is refusing to fight a war that today is universally discredited?" This is from The Guardian.
The top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee told President Bush yesterday that the White House broke the law by withholding information from the full Congressional Oversight Committees about the new domestic surveillance program. In a letter to Bush, Representative Jane Harman said the National Security Act requires the heads of the various intelligence agencies to keep the entire House and Senate intelligence committees fully and currently informed of the intelligence activities of the United States. Only in the case of a highly classified covert action can the president choose to inform a narrower group of Congress members about his decision, Harmon said. That action is defined in the law as an operation to influence political, economic, or military conditions of another country. Bush and his senior national security aides have said that appropriate members of Congress were briefed more than a dozen times about the National Security Agency's domestic surveillance operations, which Bush first approved the month after the attacks of September 11, 2001. The highly classified sessions are known to include the Gang of Eight, which is made up of the top Republican and Democrat in the House and Senate and on the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. Responding in writing to Harmon, House Intelligence Chairman Peter Hoekstra said Harmon had never previously raised concerns about the number of people briefed on the program. Many details about the scope of electronic surveillance programs remain unknown. However, Bush and his aides have asserted that the monitoring without court warrants is narrowly targeted to eavesdrop on calls and emails of people who are inside the United States and suspected of communicating with Al-Qaeda or its affiliates.
Functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI for short, enables researchers to create maps of the brain's networks in action as they process thoughts, sensations, memories, and motor commands. Now fMRI is also poised to transform the security industry, the judicial system, and our fundamental notions of privacy. By mapping the neural circuits behind deception, researchers are turning fMRI into a new kind of lie detector that's more probing and accurate than the polygraph, the standard lie detection tool employed by law enforcement and intelligence agencies for nearly a century. The polygraph is widely considered unreliable in scientific circles, partly because its effectiveness depends heavily on the intimidation skills of the interrogator. What a polygraph actually measures is the stress of telling a lie. While evidence based on polygraph tests is barred from most U.S. trials, the device is being used as a counterintelligence tool in the war on terrorism. Researchers believe that fMRI should be tougher to outwit because it detects something much harder to suppress, neurological evidence of the decision to lie. The science behind fMRI lie detection has matured with astonishing speed. The notion of mapping regions of the brain that become active during deception was first appeared in obscure radiology journals less than 5 years ago. The purpose of these studies was not to create a better lie detector, but simply to understand how the brain works. This according to Wired magazine.
A one-time member of Jack Abramoff's lobbying team, who romanced Congress and opinion leaders for lobbying accounts valued at more than $11 million, remains an assistant secretary in the Department of Labor. Raw Story has learned that Patrick Fisella, assistant secretary of Labor for Administration and Management, worked with Abramoff to lobby on behalf of dozens of clients, among them the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians, Eritrea and Saginaw Chippewa Indians. He did lobbying work with Abramoff on these accounts and is under investigation by a Senate committee, the IRS, and the Department of Justice. Pizzella is the sole member of Abramoff's lobbying retinue remaining in the Bush administration at the level of congressional confirmation. David Savafian, a one-time gambling lobbyist and Abramoff colleague, resigned and was arrested in September for obstructing justice in connection with the investigations. Abramoff pled guilty to counts of bribery fraud last week, though he is not accused of breaking any law. Scrutiny of Pizzella's lobbying work may bring more unwelcome light to Bush administration and Washington's scrambles to distance itself from the embattled lobbyist.
The people of Tallmansville, West Virginia, are trying to heal after the tragedy that killed 12 coal miners. Residents joined grieving family members last night at a candlelight vigil to remember the victims. Federal officials say the investigation will focus on what caused the explosion deep in the mine Monday. They'll also look at how information on the emergency was handled. The families initially were told that 12 members were alive, only to find out 3 hours later that all but one had died. The Sago mine has been shut down 15 times in the past. It has a record of violation that goes back for years. Fines for violation of safety regulations in the mining industry are generally surprisingly low, often less than $100.
Former Secretaries of State and Defense are meeting with President Bush today concerning the situation in Iraq. Former Secretaries of State Colin Powell, Madeleine Albright, Lawrence Eagleburger, James Baker III, George Shultz, and Alexander Haig are going to be meeting with Bush. Robert McNamara also will be at the meeting.
An executive committee member of the Southern Baptist Convention was arrested on a lewdness charge for propositioning a plainclothes policeman outside a hotel. Lonnie Latham, senior pastor at South Tulsa Baptist Church, was booked into Oklahoma County Jail Tuesday night on a misdemeanor charge of offering to engage in an act of lewdness, according to police. Latham, who has spoken out against homosexuality, asked the officer to join him in his hotel room for oral sex. Latham was arrested, and his 2005 Mercedes automobile was impounded. The arrest took place in the parking lot of the Habana Inn, which is an area where the public has complained about male prostitutes flagging down cars, Becker said. The plainclothes officers was investigating these complaints. Latham is one of four Southern Baptist Convention Executive Committee members from Oklahoma. He has also spoken out against same-sex marriage and in support of a Southern Baptist Convention directive urging its 42,000 churches to befriend gays and lesbians and try to convince them that they can become heterosexual if they accept Jesus Christ as their Savior and reject their sinful, destructive lifestyle. This is from Tulsa, Oklahoma's news services.
In Iraq, two suicide bombers killed at least 110 people and wounded more than 200 in the cities of Karbala and Ramadi today. It's the second consecutive day of concerted insurgent attacks. Another three bombs exploded in Baghdad, two of them detonated by suicide bombers, and a roadside bomb targeted a U.S. convoy near the southern Shiite holy city of Najaf, destroying a Humvee and killing at least two civilians. Coming a day after 58 people died in a wave of bombings and shootings, the latest bloodshed appeared certain to ratchet up tension between Sunni and Shiite Muslims after December's election. The bombs shattered hope that Iraq might start 2006 on a more peaceful footing.
The Chicago Transit Authority is refusing an opportunity to alleviate commuting costs for hundreds of thousands in the Windy City's low-income neighborhoods. Instead of accepting deeply discounted fuel from the Venezuela-owned Citgo Petroleum Corporation, the city is instead raising fares to solve budget shortfalls, this according to Alternet. In an October meeting with representatives from the Chicago Transit Authority, CTA, Citgo unveiled a plan to provide Chicago with low-cost diesel fuel. The company's stipulation at the bidding of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez was that the CTA, in turn, pass those savings on to poor residents in the form of free or discounted fare cards. But 2 months later, despite claims of a looming budget crisis, the CTA president has no intent or plan to accept the offer. In place of the proposed discount, which the CTA apparently does not want Chicagoans to even know about, budget shortfalls will be addressed by fare hikes. Chicagoans who are unaware of the Venezuelan offer will be hit with an increase of 25 cents per ride next month, and discounted route-to-route transfers will be eliminated for passengers paying cash. Venezuelan Consul Sanchez echoed this sentiment, quote, "Any corporation that makes a big profit in a community owes that community something in return," he said. With one of Citgo's three light oil refineries located in nearby Lamont, 30 minutes outside the city, Sanchez said, "Venezuela has a special relationship with people and community organizations in Chicago."
4 years into a mammoth reconstruction effort in Afghanistan, the United States is showing a growing willingness to cede those jobs to others. The most dramatic example will come by this summer when the U.S. military officially hands over control of the volatile southern region, plagued by persistent attacks from Islamic militias, to an international force led by the NATO alliance. The United States will cut its troop strength by 2,500, even though it's not clear how aggressively NATO troops will pursue insurgents who have shown no sign of relenting. At the same time, the U.S. government is increasingly allowing Western allies or Afghans themselves to take on the tasks of rebuilding a country that has suffered more than two decades of fighting and remains beset by poverty, drugs, and insurgency. The United States says that its shifting approach complements Afghanistan's evolution into a self-sustaining democracy and that Washington has no plans to pull out altogether. As the U.S. presence becomes less visible, however, Afghans are starting to question whether the U.S. support is sufficient. Some Afghan officials express concern that the Bush administration's priorities are simply shifting elsewhere, and that the United States may abandon their country prematurely, much the way it did in the early 1990s following the withdrawal of Soviet troops. This from the Washington Post.
Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is in critical condition following 7 hours of emergency surgery to stop widespread bleeding in his brain. The massive stroke made it unlikely that he would return to power. Vice Premier Ehud Olmert was named acting prime minister and convened the cabinet for a special session where Sharon's large chair at the center of the long oval table remained empty. Sharon's sudden turn for the worse at the height of his popularity stunned Israelis who had relied on the tough ex-general to steer them through turbulent times. Rabbis called Israelis to flock to synagogues and say special prayers. Palestinians followed reports on Sharon's condition with a mix of apprehension and glee, and some officials said they feared the dramatic events would derail the parliament elections in the West Bank and Gaza. Despite his pullout from Gaza last year, Sharon is still widely reviled in the Arab world for his tough actions against Palestinians. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas contacted Israeli officials to express concern over Sharon's health, an Abbas aide said. Close Sharon associates said they did not expect him to return to office.
In Turkey, a boy is believed to have died from bird flu, according to The Guardian. His sister also is seriously ill with the same virus. They are the first human cases outside Southeast Asia, bringing the specter of the feared pandemic to the European border. Mehmet Alakocic, 14, died on Sunday amid initial assertions from the Turkish authorities that he did not have the H5N1 virus, which causes avian flu. His sister, Fatma, was said at the time to be in critical condition, but the Turkish health minister says that preliminary tests had found that the avian flu virus, a third sibling, is suspected of having the virus too. The British government will be closely monitoring developments in Turkey after this news. Poultry workers are urged to minimize risks by maintaining good hygiene, washing hands, isolating any birds that may be sick, and alerting the authorities. The Turkish health minister said the authorities had repeated the test in two separate laboratories after an autopsy on the boy. The authorities said there are two cases that have been confirmed as positive. Another case is suspected. As in China and Vietnam, the boy who died and his siblings had close contact with chickens. Their family raised them, and they handled them on a regular basis. News of the cases will cause concern across Europe, although there is no evidence that the flu virus is being transmitted from one human to another, which is the necessary precursor to a human flu pandemic. The more often that humans become infected with H5N1, the greater the chances that it will find an opportunity to mutate into form which does have the ability to jump from human to human.
In the KBOO Morning News for Thursday, January 5th, 2006. Chris Andre, Kathleen Stevenson, and Brian Smith edited the news. KBOO's volunteer audio engineers edited the tape, and KBOO's intrepid reporters contributed local stories. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director, and she is on the board now with Boone. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Chris Andre.
We welcome your participation in the AM newsroom. To volunteer, call us at 503-231-8032, extension 202, or reach us by email, our website is www.kboo.org, or drop by the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Check out the new improved website at www.kboo.fm. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us at 5 o'clock p.m. for a solid hour of solid news on the KBOO Evening News. Portland area weather, showers decreasing, rain this afternoon and tonight with highs in the upper 40s. Tonight, rain increasing locally heavily. Temperatures in the low to mid 40s. Windy on the coast with gusts up to 65 miles an hour. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 7:30, Joanne Bowman and Dave Mazza host Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. In the first part of the program, the guest is Graham Covington, an advocate for a ban on using cell phones while driving. He's done intensive research on the issue. At 9 on the Radio Zine, Marlene Howell interviews Portland independent filmmakers Chrissy Weslow and her husband Chris Robley about their recently completed film, What's the Matter, Girlie? Currently on the film festival circuit, the film incorporates interviews and original music to address women's experience of menstruation and menopause. At 9:30, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's part 4 of Will Seaman's series on Israel and Palestine. Here guest Tanya Reinhart, professor at Tel Aviv University and the author of Israel-Palestine, How to End the 1948 War. And at 10:30 on Art Focus, host Julie Bernard interviews local artist Daniel Duthart about his Sleeping Giant at the Merrillhurst Art Center.